this certainly has gotten the attention of senior political leaders in China and in the United States.
President Trump moves to save jobs in China. It's Tuesday, May 15th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Indonesia reeling after suicide attacks. Australia witnesses a rare mass shooting. Trump and the Nobel Peace Prize. The genetics of food poisoning. New tech training. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Key U.S. lawmakers Monday attacked President Donald Trump's call to help save jobs at the Chinese technology giant ZTE, contending it overlooks American national security concerns. Senator Marco Rubio, one of Trump's former rivals for the Republican presidential nomination in 2016, said on Twitter, quote, "The problem with ZTE isn't jobs and trade, it's national security and espionage." The Florida lawmaker added, "I hope this isn't the beginning of backing down to China." Democratic Senator Ron Wyden said, questioned the timing of Trump's call to help ZTE get back into business fast after a U.S. trade ruling severely crippled the company and ordered to the U.S. Commerce Department to get it done. Trump said Sunday he's working with Chinese President Xi Jinping to ease the economic fortunes of ZTE, which employs 80,000 workers and is China's second largest maker of telecommunications equipment. For its part, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Liu Kang said Monday that China greatly appreciates the positive U.S. position on the ZTE issue. President Trump tweeted just a short time ago, "ZTE, the large Chinese phone company, buys a big percentage of individual parts from U.S. companies. This is also reflective of the larger trade deal we are negotiating with China and my personal relationship with President Xi." ZTE halted manufacturing at its Shenzhen factory after the Commerce Department blocked access to American-made components until the year 2025, contending that ZTE had failed to punish its workers for violating U.S. trade controls against North Korea and Iran. Douglas Jacobson is an export sanctions attorney who represents suppliers that do business with ZTE. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Jacobson his reaction to the U.S. president's tweet.
Well, this has caught all of those in the export controls and sanctions world certainly by surprise and with some degree of shock and awe. This is unprecedented that the President of the United States would intervene in what really is a law enforcement case.
Isn't there another side to that story in that this company had apparently done things to, for want of a better term, hurt the U.S. economically as far as the way it has done business?
ZTE was actually caught red-handed by acquiring U.S. products, using those in their devices manufactured in China, and then they were sold to embargoed countries by the United States, including Iran, North Korea, et cetera. And so they were caught by the United States. The Bureau of Industry and Security of the Commerce Department issued documents that they had actually found in ZTE's possession, indicating this scheme to violate U.S. sanctions. And ultimately, ZTE was placed 2 years ago on a denial order, and that was temporarily gave a temporary reprieve. And ultimately, the company settled in March of 2017. They pled guilty to violating U.S. export controls and sanctions laws and also had to pay a total penalty of nearly $1.2 billion. The latest salvo was in mid-April, so only 4 weeks ago, where the Commerce Department denied ZTE's export privileges because BIS alleged that ZTE did not abide by their end of the settlement agreement. So BIS invoked the denial order, which is the harshest penalty under U.S. law. And as a result, U.S. companies could no longer sell U.S. origin items to ZTE. And as a result, ZTE, since they were so dependent on U.S. software and hardware, they have stated recently that they really cannot continue to do business. And as a result, they've been trying to appeal this case to the Commerce Department. And ultimately, this certainly has gotten the attention of senior political leaders in China and in the United States, and that's led to President Trump's tweet.
Do you think this is signaling a thaw in trade relations between the United States and China?
No, I think this is an independent case that really has to be looked at on its own. And I think this really is delinked from all of the other trade-related issues on the tariffs, on the aluminum, on steel, and on intellectual property. On March 7th, 2017, Secretary of Commerce Ross said in a press release that this investigation and this unprecedented penalty reflects ZTE's egregious scheme to evade U.S. law and systematically mislead investigators. So for them to now do a 180 on that tough talk, I think really indicates the President Trump's willingness to perhaps make a concession to China in exchange perhaps for China's assistance with the North Korea situation and to make concessions perhaps in other trade areas. But generally speaking, this is a unique case to ZTE, and I think that's probably it's certainly unprecedented in that regard.
And has made you a happy man today.
I think my clients, if this proceeds, I think that they certainly will be pleased. And I think it obviously makes ZTE happiest of all. I think that the parties that are going to be unhappy, however, is U.S. law enforcement. I think that U.S. law enforcement, I think that this is going to be the real interesting fallout of how U.S. law enforcement, who has been taking a very hard line on ZTE and other companies who violate U.S. export controls and sanctions, how they are going to react given that the president basically going over their heads and intervening in really what's essentially a law enforcement case.
Douglas Jacobson is an export and sanctions attorney who represents suppliers that do business with ZTE. He spoke with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. Bangladesh arrests 1,700 in nationwide anti-drug drive. Staid Singapore prepares for historic Trump-Kim summit. New Malaysian Prime Minister removes Attorney General. China sends trade envoy to United States, welcomes Trump ZTE comments. At least 30 climbers reach Everest summit, including a double amputee. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Indonesia is stepping up security in the world's largest Muslim nation after a series of suicide attacks involving members of two families in the country's second-largest city, Surabaya, in East Java. Monday, four members of one family riding on two motorbikes died after they detonated explosives outside police headquarters, wounding several police and passers-by. Sunday, a family of six, including girls aged 9 and 12, died in separate attacks on three Christian churches, killing at least 13 other people and wounding dozens. That attack was claimed by the Islamic State-inspired group JAD. Another three members of one family died and two wounded when a bomb exploded Sunday in an apartment complex near the city. President Joko Widodo condemned the attacks. Greg Feely is an associate professor at the Australian National University who specializes in Islam, politics, and terrorism in Indonesia. Following Sunday's church attacks, he told VOA's Victor Beatty, such incidents involving families is unprecedented in Indonesian jihadism.
I'm not aware of any other cases globally quite like this. We've had brothers, adult brothers and the like, who, that have undertaken suicide bombings together, but not entire families.
Is there an uptick in jihadism in Indonesia?
Not particularly, in fact. There's certainly quite a few thousand supporters of the Islamic State, of ISIS, in Indonesia. But they have been, until now, very well contained by the Indonesian police. The Indonesian police have a very effective counter-terrorism policing operation, and they have arrested well over 1,000 people in the last 15, 16 years, and successfully prosecuted many of those people for terrorism offences. And almost every day they are uncovering new cells, new operations, arresting people. So they have done remarkably well. But nonetheless, we unfortunately know that they can't catch everyone. And in this particular case, the family seem to have quite successfully evaded detection. And the father was the head of a local branch of a pro-ISIS organization called JAD, but he had no terrorism convictions. The police knew that he'd been to Syria, but had been deported. He and his family had been there, but they hadn't been able to charge him on it because in Indonesia, being a foreign fighter is not an offense.
President Joko Widodo was quick to visit the scene of the attacks. He said this act is barbaric and beyond the limits of humanity, causing victims among members of society, the police, and even innocent children.
The revulsion that he expressed at the nature of this attack, I think, is shared very widely across Indonesian society. Even very conservative Islamic organizations are coming out and condemning this attack with strong language. The very notion that parents could sacrifice their own children in this way is utterly repugnant to most Indonesians. And so it's hard to imagine that this is anything other than an extremely counterproductive jihadist action by this family. Whether they thought of things in strategic terms, but usually terrorists will try to not kill fellow Muslims, they'll try to kill people who are non-Muslims or people who are working for the state. But in this particular case, to kill your own family members, that's something that most people are utterly repulsed by.
Greg Feely said these incidents represent a spike in jihadist attacks in the country not seen since January 2016, when militants launched a bombing and shooting spree in Jakarta that left 8 dead, including 5 attackers and more than 20 wounded. Happening now in Asia, a delegation from North Korea arrived in Beijing Monday for talks, according to news outlets in Japan and South Korea. The visit comes a week after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un held talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping in the northeastern port city of Dalian, their second meeting since late March. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. We hope your day's going well. 7 people were found dead over the weekend at a farm in Western Australia. It's reported to be the nation's worst mass shooting for more than 20 years. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney about the unusual news that came as a shock to most Australians.
The bodies of 4 children and 3 adults were discovered Friday in the town of Osmington in Western Australia, 280 kilometres south of Perth, the state capital. This type of gun violence is rare in Australia. Media reports say the killings are the worst mass shootings since the Port Arthur massacre on the island state of Tasmania in 1996. In Port Arthur, 35 people were shot dead by a lone gunman, Martin Bryant, who remains in prison. The shootings led to a comprehensive overhaul of Australia's gun laws, which drastically cut gun-related crime. The measures banned automatic and semi-automatic weapons. The reasons behind Friday's tragedy may never be known. 2 firearms were found at the scene, which is still being pored over by forensic examiners. A murder-suicide is suspected, although this hasn't been confirmed by law enforcement officials. 3 generations of the same family were among the victims. Katrina Miles was found dead alongside her four children, aged 8, 10, 12 and 13, and her 58-year-old mother, Cinder. The body of an older man was slumped in a chair on the veranda outside. Nearby Margaret River is a popular surfing town, and many locals have expressed their horror at the deaths. The president of the local shire, Pamela Townsend, says the deaths have shocked residents.
It's such a small community and it will have a huge effect, is already having a huge effect. Because in this community we're so well connected.
Mark McGowan, the state premier of Western Australia, has also reacted to the tragedy.
Four young children, a mother and a grandmother being killed in this way is just a terribly distressing and sad thing. And I think we all feel it keenly.
Phil Mercer for VOA News. Sydney.
Coming up, divided opinions on a potential Nobel Peace Prize candidate. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA programs. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, a U.S. diplomat has left Pakistan for Afghanistan after Islamabad had earlier barred him from leaving the country for his role in a fatal road accident. The government agreed to allow U.S. defense attaché Joseph Emmanuel Hall to exit the country after U.S. officials assured he will be tried under American laws. This and many other stories and features are on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded each year to a person or group that has done the most or best work for fraternity between nations. Since it was first awarded in 1901, it has been presented to social activists like Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela. Now, a group of House Republicans has nominated Donald Trump for the Peace Prize. The suggestion has prompted both cheers and criticism. Andre Durzak has the story as Anna Rice narrates.
That's very nice. Nobel. I just want to get the job done.
A number of House Republicans nominated President Trump for the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize for trying to bring peace to the Korean Peninsula. South Korea's President Moon Jae-in supported the idea.
Well, I just think that President Moon was very nice when he suggested it. I want to get peace. The main thing, we want to get peace.
Trump critics questioned his desire for peace, pointing out that President Trump has called for an increase in military spending and in America's nuclear arsenal, and saying that he does not rule out the possibility of using force against North Korea. But supporters like Republican Senator Lindsey Graham say the prize would recognize the new potential for peace he has created. For many, that if is a big one. A permanent peace deal on the Korean Peninsula is far from assured. And though the two sides have agreed to meet, nothing is certain. President Trump himself said numerous times that if upcoming talks aren't fruitful, he will, in his words, respectfully leave the meeting. But the lack of a definitive peace deal has not deterred the Nobel Committee in the past. The Vietnam War had not ended when Le Duc Tho and Henry Kissinger were awarded the prize. Yasser Arafat, who shared the prize with Israeli leaders Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres for efforts towards Middle East peace, was quoted saying, "We shall never stop until we can go back home and Israel is destroyed." And one does not need to be a peacemaker to be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. That list includes Juan Perón, three times president of Argentina, who restricted civil liberties, Italian fascist ruler Benito Mussolini, and even Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, who executed hundreds of thousands of his own people. The 2018 winner of the Nobel Peace Prize will be announced in October. Anna Rice for Andrei Dzerkach for VOA News, Washington.
This news from VOA Asia, the ruling Communist Party of Vietnam will call together hundreds of members who it believes can resist corruption and vigorously review others to ease a growing problem for the Southeast Asian country's government. party is due now to approve an elite team of 600 party members. You're always approved to visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a new approach for detecting food poisoning is being used to investigate the recent outbreak of E. coli bacteria in romaine lettuce growing in the United States state of Arizona. The tainted produce has sickened at least 84 people in 19 states. The new method used by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention relies on genetic sequencing. And as VOA's Faiza El-Masri tells us in this report narrated by Faith Lapidus, it has the potential to revolutionize the detection of food poisoning outbreaks.
Lauren Bush has firsthand experience with food poisoning. Over a decade ago, she got extremely sick after eating a spinach salad. She suffered mysterious flu-like symptoms for 6 months.
I remember turning to my parents and saying, I'm really scared. I mean, do you think I could die before they figure out what it is?
Finally, doctors discovered the source of her distress, E. coli bacteria in the spinach. Bush's experience is not uncommon. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, around 48 million Americans get sick and 3,000 die from food poisoning every year. The new genetic technique is helping scientists connect the dots in seemingly unrelated outbreaks of foodborne illnesses. Comparing whole genome sequencing on DNA samples from different people who've become ill allows them to see if the bacteria are the same strain and how resistant they are to current medicine. Initially, health workers sent samples to the CDC, but now all 50 states are getting money to help them set up their own labs. It speeds up the analysis.
It takes about 40 hours to sequence, and you probably have 8 hours of prep time before going on the instrument. And then once you have the sequence information off the sequencer, it's kind of like having a shredded paper document. So we have to use computational biology techniques to piece the genome back together, and that'll usually take a few hours. So all in all, the process from start to finish can be achieved in less than 72 hours.
While initially focused on Listeria, the technique was effective for identifying E. coli strains.
So for the current romaine outbreak, we have been able to get some sequencing results back. We can see that the bacteria in that outbreak are very closely related to one another.
By the end of the year, labs expect to use this technique for other common causes of food poisoning. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Silicon Valley, the U.S. hub of technology, is getting so expensive that tech workers are struggling to get by, and startup companies are questioning whether to locate there. One city thousands of kilometers away is ready to welcome tech companies with an experienced workforce in hopes of becoming the next Silicon Valley. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti takes us to the city, which has a new tech university that could be replicated anywhere in the world.
Technology companies here pump $7.7 billion into the city's economy and hire 75,000 people. Job postings for emerging tech are up 40% over last year, and unemployment is only 3%. No, this isn't Silicon Valley. It's Middle America, Indianapolis, Indiana.
It's on the cusp of what we're seeing as being sort of a tech boom.
So Courtney Spence founded Kenzie Academy. It's a coding university to attract startups to America's heartland and to supply them with trained software developers.
So we know when it's entirely full and we know when it's entirely empty.
Steve Hirschberger is hiring local Kenzie interns for his beer management system rather than flying in coders and engineers from Silicon Valley.
The big universities used to train for that. They don't train for it today.
Through these local business partnerships, students learn outside the classroom. Maya Williams will graduate in December of 2019 as part of Kenzie's first class. She moved to Indianapolis from Louisiana to study medical software engineering.
New Orleans is very healthcare-based, but their technology was lacking somewhat, and there wasn't really a job market out there for that.
If not Indiana, how about Asia? Kenzie founders plan to duplicate the academy model starting in Malaysia. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Indianapolis, Indiana.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Perhaps you've been listening to us on the radio, like CCU Radio at National Chung Cheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. We thank everyone there who is listening, and wherever you may happen to be hearing our program, you can get us online as well, iTunes and SoundCloud, and of course we're streaming on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead.